Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Parallels between the causes of World War I and the world today, according to historian Margaret McMillan. A globalizing economy, new global communications technology, rising nationalist fervor, an over-the-top war on terror, and weak or ambitious heads of state. Does this mean we're on the verge of World War III? Not necessarily, but let's talk about parallels between 1914 and 2014. Historian Margaret McMillan has a major new history book out called The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914. And she had an op-ed about these parallels in the New York Times. She joins us from Oxford, England, where she is warden of St. Anthony's College. Hello from New York, Professor McMillan. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you very much.
Warden of St. Anthony's College, does that mean you corral the inmates?
Exactly. They're all terrified of me, and I never let them out. I don't know why we call it that. It's just one of these Oxford terms. I'm just head of a college.
Here we are in the 100th anniversary year of World War I's outbreak. Why are historians like yourself still debating how it got started?
Well, we still don't know, and I'm not sure we ever will know. There are too many causes in a funny way. There's so many reasons why it might have happened. The human error, nationalism, imperial rivalries, economic rivalries, mistakes, railway timetables, and you can make a good argument for every one of them. And so I think we'll never know for sure.
So let's look at some of the parallels from your list between then and now. And some of these might surprise people. A big one is things seeming to go faster at unprecedented speeds in technology and in cultural upheaval. We certainly think of our own time that way. But you mentioned globalizing communications that you compare to the Internet. Was there really a parallel to the Internet at that time, which was even before radio?
Yes, I think there was, because I think you got the world being linked together in ways that it hadn't been linked together before. Not the Internet, of course, but telegraphs, railways, steamships, and the beginnings of wireless. And people were very conscious that they were living in a very different world, that on your morning newspaper in London or New York, you could get the latest news from Beijing on the other side of the world, news that would have been unthinkable even 10 years previously. Airplanes were just beginning to make their appearance. The internal combustion engine was creating a new type of vehicle on land. And I think people living at the time had the sense that they were living in a very rapidly changing world. And it unsettled them. I mean, I think a lot of people welcomed the change, but living through change is not always easy. And I think we're seeing something of that today. I mean, the technologies are very different, but I think the feelings are often the same.
And a globalizing economy, like today's multinational corporations gaining more power. There was some kind of discussion like that over 100 years ago. And the related parallel to that you write is the backlash to globalization, which is nativism and localism. So where was that happening a century ago?
Well, it was happening in nationalisms. It was happening in chauvinism. It was happening with anti-Semitism, sadly. There was a rise of hostility towards Jews who were seen often very wrongly as people who are cosmopolitan, who didn't belong to the countries in which they lived, and who were also seen as agents of the new capitalism which was changing the world. A lot of this was very misguided. But these were, I think, strong emotions, much as we have hostility to immigrants today in parts of the world. Fears that somehow the world is changing too fast, and you want to cling to what you know, you want to cling to your own communities.
And related to that, terrorism and an over-the-top response to terrorism. Did they use the word terrorism 100 years ago the way we use it today?
They don't use it as much as we now use it. I mean, we talk about a war on terror. They didn't talk about that. They talked more about anarchists and nihilists. But terror was something that was beginning to be used. I mean, the terrorists themselves, the people who threw the bombs or assassinated heads of states or tried to destroy pictures that they didn't approve of. I mean, they used the words terror, and they said the application of terror can help to change society, can help to bring the whole rotten structure down, which I think is in part the motivation of terrorists today, that they somehow believe that through terrorist activities they're going to make these huge changes and huge political structures are going to suddenly come collapsing down.
If there's one oversimplified and, you know, incredibly reduced version that's popular of what started World War One, it was the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. But that's not terrorism in the sense that we think of it today, which is attacks against civilians rather than officials. So was there that also?
There were attacks against civilians, and the man who killed the Archduke also killed his wife. Who could, I think, really be seen as an innocent bystander in all this. But there were, I mean, there were terrorists in Paris who threw bombs onto the floor of the Paris Stock Exchange. And there was one famous terrorist in Paris who threw a bomb into a restaurant because he said, any middle-class person I see is an enemy. And so I think there are some parallels with today.
Listeners, any questions for historian Margaret McMillan on parallels between 1914 and 2014, or for that matter, if you want to get into the weeds on the causes of World War One and what we should learn from them, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Her new book is called The Road to World War One. Sorry, I'm getting this back out in front of me. The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914. You compare the Middle East today to the Balkans of a century ago. In what ways?
Well, I think the key way in which they're to be compared is that both were areas which had their own conflicts. I mean, they were troubled areas. There were divisions in the Balkans, ethnic divisions, religious divisions, which were causing conflict, and you have similar divisions in the Middle East today. But what made them dangerous to a broader world was that they also involved great power interests. And so you had bigger powers outside the regions taking an interest in what was going on there, and in some cases backing one faction or another. And so in the Balkans, you had Russia and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, for example, who were vying for influence before 1914. And today in the Middle East, you have the United States, you have Russia, which is trying, I think, to reassert itself in the Middle East, and you have possibly Iran, which obviously has a strong interest in what goes on. Down the road, you may well have China taking an interest in the Middle East. And so I think these volatile areas can be dangerous to a broader community because of the interests they can draw in.
But aren't we beyond a World War III, given the lessons from the horrors of World Wars I and II? I mean, 40-plus countries fought in World War I, depending on, you know, who you count. Today, 40-plus countries are meeting in Europe to try and end the Syrian civil war. Is that a sign that some lessons from a century ago have been learned?
Oh, I think so. And I don't think, I mean, I think it's important to say that history never repeats itself exactly or even roughly. I think we have moved a long way. I think we understand the importance of international institutions more. We understand the importance of cooperation more. We have more international institutions. We have more developed legal international system. But that doesn't mean that we are free from the same mistakes, passions, rivalries, fears that people felt 100 years ago. And so I think we should be on our guard against being too complacent. We're not that much smarter than people, or if at all smarter than people were 100 years ago, and yet look at the mess they made of it.
Here's a history question coming in from David in Manhattan. David, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. I'm just not in opposition to what you said earlier about the use of the word terrorism. You could make the argument that the 20th century, this century of violence and terrorism, did begin on June 28, 1914. There were six young men, and their aggregate age was 20 years old, and they all belonged to an underground terrorist group called the Black Hand. And when they joined this terrorist group, they took an oath, and in the oath they used the words, they say, "I espouse the use of terrorist action to bring about a greater Serbia." That was their goal. So they were actively involved and pursued this technique that we call terrorism. And you could argue that this was the beginning of the 20th century that we are continuing to be a part of.
Professor McMillan, do you know that incident?
Yeah. Well, they were young men, mainly from Bosnia, who were supported by people in the Black Hand, and yeah, they did take a sort of blood-curdling oath. I mean, it was very much sort of, you know, oaths at midnight and so on. But the terror had been around. The use of terror had been around in the 19th century as well. But I agree with the caller that I think the assassination in Sarajevo on June the 28th, 1914, helped to trigger off a really dreadful century. I mean, and when we look back at the 20th century, it really is one of the worst centuries in human history. I mean, it's been also, curiously enough, a century of great progress but pretty awful in many ways.
Margaret McMillan, professor of international history at Oxford and author of The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914, and maybe the biggest contribution of your book, at least in the way that it's being reviewed at a number of places, is that you focus on the ineffectiveness of the individuals, of the heads of state a century ago. You write, if there had been someone with the strength of a Churchill or a Bismarck to resist some of the pressures that wound up in World War I, maybe it could have been avoided. What were some of those pressures, and who was weak?
Well, the pressures were pressures of nationalism, and one of the new things that was happening was that statesmen, people in positions of authority, were having to pay an awful lot more attention to public opinion. And so if you got the public getting roiled about something, you know, you got the public saying, you know, we have to stand up and fight our enemies, or we have to build more battleships, or we need more soldiers, it was hard for the politicians often to resist it. So I think that's a new factor. And I think what you also got was increased fear. There was an arms race, and so there was a sort of panicky feeling around among Europe's leaders as they didn't keep on spending and they didn't keep up. They were going to be really at the mercy of their neighbors and of their enemies. But I think some of the statesmen in positions of authority were sadly lacking. And part of it, I think, was the hereditary principle, because you had in three key states men who'd inherited their positions purely as a result of accident of birth, and in fact accidents of some deaths that occurred on their way to the throne. But they all had great power. I mean, the Kaiser in Germany, Kaiser Wilhelm II, under the German constitution, had a lot of power over the military and foreign affairs. The Tsar of Russia was, in theory, an absolute ruler, although he had to accept some limits on his rule. And the Emperor of Austria-Hungary, Franz Joseph, was also had a great deal of power. And so what you had were people who, in my view, were not up to the job. I mean, the Kaiser was a sort of bully and a blowhard and someone who boasted a lot. Franz Joseph was old, tired, sick, and really main thought, I think, was just to hang on to what his empire was and not change much. And the Tsar of Russia was, I think, a weak man, a decent man, but a weak man. And in the final crisis, they had tremendous power and tremendous responsibilities, and I think they allowed themselves to be carried on by events rather than trying to control them. They could have said no to their generals when they said, we need to go to war, but they didn't.
How do you assess today's most important leaders by these measures?
Well, I think President Obama, I think the jury's still out. I mean, I'm an historian, so we never like to assess anything until about 20 years later. I mean, I think in some ways he has the capacity to be a great leader, but has he done? I don't know how Americans feel about it. Has he done all he could have done, or has he been handicapped by a very badly divided Congress? I think Vladimir Putin is a very powerful leader who is trying to reassert Russia's position in the world. But I don't see many leaders around of the stature of a Roosevelt, for example, both Roosevelts, or of a Woodrow Wilson, or of a JFK, John F. Kennedy, or of a Winston Churchill.
Of course, Wilson and FDR, not to mention Churchill, did all go to war.
Yeah, they did all go to war, but they resisted, and they made a collective decision. I mean, Churchill only went to war he didn't make the decision to go to war. He was actually not even part of the cabinet at the time, as I remember, but Churchill was prepared to go to war when all other alternatives had been exhausted. And Woodrow Wilson tried to keep the United States out of the First World War, and I think was provoked into it by German actions, and I think the United States was provoked into it by German actions. And the parallel I really find interesting is with John F. Kennedy, who in the Cuban Missile Crisis was under real pressure to go to war against the Soviet Union for its provocative and dangerous actions in putting forces into Cuba, and resisted and went for negotiations. And I think we should all be grateful to him, because an all-out nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union wouldn't have left much of anything for any of us.
Mm-hmm. Another history question from George in Princeton. George, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Sure can.
Hello?
Yeah, we can hear you fine.
Okay, great. Yeah, I was concerned about the colonialism that went on, not only from France and England into Africa, particularly Northern Africa and the Near East, but also throughout the Boer Wars were particularly fought over the fact that Europe had just seen Africa as a great colonial boondoggle. And that actually started after the American Revolution, when France went bankrupt, helping the United States achieve independence, and then basically had its own revolution, and then went out through all of Europe, particularly Austria and Germany, and carried on incredibly brutal warfare against its neighbors, which World War One was almost a retaliation for.
So not to forget colonialism as a root cause of World War One.
Yeah, no, I think colonial rivalries played into the rivalries among European nations, although paradoxically some of the worst colonial rivalries, those between Britain and France and between Britain and Russia, had actually been more or less laid to rest by 1914, although there was still rivalry in the Balkans and over the expected fall of the Ottoman Empire. So I think the caller is right, and colonial rivalries are very much part of the picture.
If you want the world to take away one thing from your book, adding to the conversation about what started World War One and what we might learn from it for today, what might it be?
I think the thing I take away is you know, try and overcome the fears that can build up, fears of your neighbor, suspicions of your neighbor. It's so important to keep on talking, to keep on negotiating, to keep on trying to build bridges. And I think what happened in Europe before 1914 is you got the gulfs getting deeper and deeper and the mutual suspicions getting greater. And so when the crisis came, they were ready for a war.
Margaret McMillan, professor of international history at Oxford and the author now of The War That Ended Peace, The Road to 1914, and also the recent op-ed in the New York Times that looks at parallels between then and now from 100 years ago. Thank you so much for giving us some time.
Thank you.